from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Author Meenal Hajratwala says it may be the fastest growing dispersal of people in the world, the 20 to 30 million Indians now living outside of their native land. Hajratwala knows this story because it's hers. Her relatives started leaving India in the early 20th century, first to Fiji and South Africa, later to the United States, Canada, and New Zealand. Her new book is about this extraordinary diaspora, the journey of Indian families all over the globe. It's a story about what is gained and what is left behind, about identity and integration, and the impact that journey has had on families and nations all over the world. Leaving India, next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Bhupendra Hajratwala had just been offered his first full-time job in America when his new employer asked him this question. "You have a really long name. Can we just call you Bob?" Bhupendra, who'd left India to study in America, paused and then slowly shook his head. "When I learned English," he said, "refrigerator was a hard word, but I learned it. I think you can learn to say Bhupendra." As a new resident of a new land, Bhupendra Hajratwala held fast to more than his name. But what to keep and what to leave behind are ongoing questions for Indian families like the Hajratwalas and the tens of millions of others who have left India to form what may be the largest diaspora of any people in the world today. Why they've left, what they've kept, and the evolving nature of family and identity are the topics of a new book called Leaving India. Its author is Meenal Hajratwala, Bhupendra's daughter. She's a San Francisco-born journalist who once worked for the San Jose Mercury and then spent the last several years traveling the globe, tracking down her extended family to tell this story. And she joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
Happy to have you with us. Let's begin by talking about the scope of what you've called perhaps the largest diaspora in the world today. Began in the 19th century, in part because of the end of slavery in the British Empire in the 1830s and the need then for labor in other parts of the British Empire. Tell us the beginning of the story of the Indian diaspora.
Yes. On August 1st, 1834, slavery was outlawed in the British Empire, and that meant that in British colonies all around the world that had been depending on African labor to plant sugar and harvest crops and build mines and railroads, there was suddenly no one to work those jobs. And so the British Empire looked around for a solution, and they looked at India, their largest colony, and they saw millions of peasants who didn't have work. There were drought conditions and famine conditions in different areas. And they said these would be great people to work, but they can't really afford passage on a ship. So we're going to make them an offer they can hardly refuse, which is, here you go. Here's free ticket to a ride on a boat, a slave ship with the shackles taken out. And you can get in and go over to Fiji or Guyana or Mauritius or any of a number of places and work for 5 years. And that's your contract. That's the trade. Work for 5 years in exchange for this passage. And you'll make a little bit of money. And so that system was called indentured labor, and it lasted from 1834 to 1920. And about 1.5 million Indians left India under that system.
And that's how it began. But there were also people like your earlier family members who left with a more entrepreneurial pursuit as well. What was it that drew people like your great-great-grandparents and great-great-uncles to places like Fiji, places like South Africa?
That's right, because in these colonies, there grew up larger communities of Indians. And so those Indians needed services. And so some people looked at that and saw an opportunity and decided to go. And they were able to afford tickets. And my great-grandfather, Mothiram, in 1909, actually mortgaged the family's land and bought a ticket to Fiji, where he worked as a tailor.
and then went on to become quite an entrepreneur, quite in a sense, an empire builder as well in a particular trade.
Yes, in a way, he started a small tailoring shop, and he actually died quite young, but his sons and his grandsons ran that shop, and it became one of the largest department stores in the South Pacific Islands.
Tell us something about the relationship of those early emigres to places like Fiji and also to South Africa, because they were people of color going to places of color. What about the relationship between, for example, in South Africa, the Indians coming and those who were native South Africans?
Yes, Indians often in those colonies found themselves in a kind of middle position between the Africans in South Africa or the native Fijians in Fiji and the British or white ruling classes of those countries. So the Indians were certainly kept in a second-class status. They did not have citizenship rights. They weren't allowed to vote. And they suffered a lot of discrimination. They were called coolies. There were laws to keep them off the public sidewalks, for example, inside South Africa. But at the same time, they didn't suffer the experience of colonialism that the native people suffered in those places, which was having someone come in from the outside and take over their lands and really exploit them in that particular way. So they were in a kind of middle position, and particularly the more entrepreneurial or business-owning Indians, such as the ones in my family, fell into a class that economists now call pariah capitalists, which is this kind of middle place that we also see with, for example, Korean shopkeepers in Los Angeles, or Jewish people have been in this position in a lot of places, where they become kind of a scapegoat class.
I want to explore also what happened then in that relationship. And by way of getting there, tell us something about what happened with Mahatma Gandhi, because he spent 20 years in South Africa and in a sense began to build some of his tactics for what he would later do back in his native India. But he also had a view that the cause that he cared most about, the rights of Indians in South Africa, should really be kept separate from the blacks of South Africa. Walk us through what his view was and some of the resulting tensions that later took place between those two groups.
Yes. So Gandhi went to South Africa in the late 1800s as a young lawyer, and he had come from a fairly privileged background in India. And in South Africa, he was kicked off a train, he was spit at on the streets, and he came to realize that there was this real oppression that the Indians in South Africa were suffering, which he found to be completely unjustified. And he looked for his rationale and his protests at the 1857 letter that the Queen Victoria had written at the time when she took over India. And she had said, "We're going to give our Indian subjects the same rights and privileges as all our subjects throughout the empire." And so Gandhi started out writing letters to the editor and petitions to the courts saying, "This is our status. We're British subjects. We don't deserve to be treated this way. We are British subjects equal to other people in Britain." And what he did not say was that Africans are also British subjects in that way. And in fact, his class of Indians in South Africa, one of the things that they were arguing for was, for example, the right for their children to be educated separately from the Africans. They didn't want to be grouped in with the black Africans. They wanted to be treated as Indians, as British subjects. And so that was sort of his period of activism in South Africa. Now, he did pioneer these nonviolent tactics in South Africa. He was arrested multiple times. He led people in mass protests. They burned paperwork that was offensive because it treated them as second-class citizens. And in a way, I think Gandhi, as a nonviolent activist, is one of the greatest gifts of the diaspora back to India. But that split that he and other Indians of his time and place felt between themselves and the native people did come back to haunt the Indians in South Africa, even to this day. In the 1940s, for example, there were race riots between Indians and Africans, and divide and conquer was a very effective strategy. that the apartheid government used.
Meenal Haj Ratwala is our guest this hour. Her new book is called Leaving India, My Family's Journey from Five Villages to Five Continents. I want to fast forward to a more contemporary time in a moment, but one more question that I think is so telling in some ways about this combination of both tension and alliance that happened between Indians and black South Africans. And that had to do with black South Africans no longer being able to eat at certain restaurants, some of which were run by Indians, including one by your great-great-uncle, is that right?
Yes.
And part of the strategy, because they wanted those customers, even though there was this tension, they wanted those customers, is they developed a kind of unique fast food that could be takeout, right, so that they could still sell to black South Africans, even though they couldn't sit down in the restaurant.
Yes, exactly. My great-great-uncle was named Ganda Kapitan, and he came to South Africa early in the period, so there was some overlap between him and Mahatma Gandhi's time in South Africa. And he had a small restaurant which served all kinds of curries and mostly all vegetarian food because he was a strict vegetarian. And at some point, probably in the 1940s, a law came down that Africans were not allowed to sit down and eat in restaurants anymore. And this was really a problem for the Africans, of course, and also for the Indian restaurateurs, who a large part of their clientele by that point was African customers. And so they came up with the idea of taking – this was before there was styrofoam or any kind of fast food containers. They took bread loaves, cut them in half, pulled out the soft bready filling, and stuffed them with the curry. And that became the takeout container, and that was called the bunny chow. And it was the product of segregation, and today people consider it one of South Africa's national dishes.
And indicative, again, of this interesting tension that and alliance at the same time that happened between two peoples of color in that particular locale.
Exactly, because that alliance was natural. It was always, you know, it was always building. And for example, Indian workers and African workers in the mines worked together, but by law they were forced apart. They were not allowed to have a joint union, for example. They had to have separate unions. So there was always this tension between kind of coming together along economic interests or cultural interests or just sort of normal human relationships, and then the government pulling them apart, as well as playing on people's own prejudices.
Let's fast forward to the middle part of the 20th century and the diaspora that began to include not only former places in the British Empire like Fiji and South Africa, but in New Zealand, but also the United States and Canada, and to the story of your parents who came to the United States and became in part also part of this country's sort of tangled history with race and with people of color. Tell us something about your story, Bhupendra Haj Ratwala, why he came, and what his experience was when he first came to the middle of the United States.
My father came in 1963 as a student, and he came from India by way of Fiji, where most of his family was by that point. And he arrived in San Francisco and then went to school in Boulder, Colorado, where he had a pretty insulated experience on a campus. He had, you know, some other Indian students, some Chinese students. By this point in American history, there was actually a move to bring in foreign students as part of the effort to win the Cold War. So foreign students and scholars were being welcomed. And then a couple years after he arrived in 1965, the immigration law actually changed. So in the census of 1960, there were 9,000 people of Indian descent living in the United States. After 1965, 10,000 Indians every year were allowed in. And so there was started to be this massive change in the demographics, which we see coming through to this day. And when my father finished his master's degree, he went to Chicago. And in Chicago, he really had his first experience of American racism in a systematic way. He's rather dark-skinned, and people thought he was black, and he had trouble finding an apartment, finding a job. This was the time when there were signs on businesses that said, no blacks, no Jews, no dogs. And that was his shocking encounter.
And yet, despite that overt racism that he faced, in a sense, you're also saying that his timing was good. He came at a time when there was a hunger in the United States for people with particular skills and talents and academic expertise in particular, very different from the earlier part of the 20th century when there were laws restricting immigration, citizenship, and all the rest.
Yes, exactly. And the change in the immigration law actually came about partly as a result of the civil rights movement as well, so that there was this kind of lessening of a xenophobia that had been very intense in the United States.
Meenal Hajratwala, her book again, Leaving India, joining this hour. What were the motivations for people like your parents and so many others to come here, to leave India? Was it the old draw of immigration, the classic draw of opportunity, of education, leaving poverty behind? What was it that prompted this enormous push of people away from their native land?
You know, my father in particular never had an American dream. He migrated here almost accidentally. He was looking into master's degree programs. He applied and he happened to get admission to something in the United States. And then a series of opportunities opened up for him. And it wasn't as if he'd set out to come to the United States and settle here. But there was what you're saying about a classic impetus was certainly there, that the lack of economic opportunity for people from the villages in India, particularly those who had some education but then couldn't find jobs to match their skill set, was certainly there. And so that, you know, historians talk about that as kind of the push factor of migration. And then the pull factor happened in a lot of different places. So at that same time, people in my family were migrating to England and to Canada and to Australia and New Zealand eventually and to Hong Kong. And so much more, the world was opening up in a certain way and the borders were becoming a little more permeable.
America, in many ways, obviously, has been the beneficiary of stories like your family's and the talents that came here. But is India the poorer? What's been lost by the country itself, by people like your father coming to Colorado?
That was the great debate of the 1960s. This phenomenon was called the brain drain, and thousands of Indians and also Chinese and people from other parts of Asia were moving to the West for these educational opportunities and career opportunities. And there were debates in the United Nations. Someone from Nigeria stood up and said, you know, we're a very poor country. If we lose even one doctor, that might be a third of the doctors we have in that area. And
because
that's a big loss.
People didn't come here just to get an education. They stayed.
Exactly. They stayed. And that was the big change. After 1965, they were able to stay. And certainly what they could make in U.S. dollars was a phenomenal amount compared to what they would make back home. And also the conditions were in some ways easier and better for them. There were, for the Indians in particular, there was an investment in education in India, but there wasn't quite yet the job market to hire those people. So people would come out of schools with engineering degrees, but then the only work they could find might be as a clerk, and they wouldn't be able to use their skills.
How much tension is there, even today, on that score? Is there resentment towards people like your father who came here to capture that kind of opportunity rather than bringing it back home?
There is some tension, and I think there's also regret. You know, many people who are in the diaspora also feel a pull to go back and give back. And one thing that we're seeing a little bit now is that some people of my generation, the second generation, are partly as a result of the economic climate in the United States right now, finding that India is a great place to go. They want to raise their own children there, at least for a few years. They want to contribute, and they want to go back to India because India's economy is expanding and there's money to be made over there.
Do you feel that pull?
I don't feel the pull to move back to India permanently myself, but I love India. I love going there, and I would not be opposed to living there for a while. I have some projects that I would be interested in doing there, so maybe a future book.
I want to ask you something about what is always a challenge and what you write about a lot in your book, about what you hold on to in terms of identity. I told the story at the beginning about your father wanting to hold on to his name. He didn't want to be Bob. He wanted to be Bhupendra. What is the heart of that dilemma, do you think? And how does that differ generationally for people like your parents first and perhaps differently for you?
I love that story about my father, and I was just thinking of it yesterday because there was this Texas lawmaker who said some ridiculous things yesterday about how people should change their names to make things easier for Americans and was getting a lot of flack for that. I think that we all, in some way or another, no matter which generation we're from, we're looking for a way to have an integrated personality and to have, my parents always spoke of it as the best of both worlds. And I think that everyone is doing that in some way. Now, where they choose the best of both worlds, there could be heated debate over. And but even the people who cling the most strongly to tradition, for example, they might eat only Indian food and they might marry in the traditional ways, but they still might wear blue jeans from time to time, or they might, have toast in the morning instead of the traditional meal. So,
or I remember at one point in your book, you talk about, I can't remember which part of your family it was that had traditional Indian bread 6 days a week, but one day a week you had whole wheat.
Exactly. That was my family in London. And they said, you know, we're in this country now, we're in England, and we'll eat English bread on Sundays.
Let me read one passage of your book that deals with this topic. You write, "Each time I cross a border, I feel the push and pull in my body, a cacophony of competing desires. And always there are choices to make, what to assimilate and what to reject."
Yes, I think that's right. And in that place, I've sort of phrased it a little bit negatively so that assimilation and rejection are both kind of negative options. But there's one can also reword it as what to embrace from one side and what to embrace from another side. And ultimately, it doesn't seem to me that there are sides. You know, ultimately, we're single people and we have integrated identities and we don't have to do so much choosing if we're able to just kind of be natural with ourselves.
And what does that mean for you in terms of what you feel you've integrated as a second generation Indian American that's most precious to you to hold on to?
Mm-hmm. I came out as a lesbian when I was 19 years old, and there was a long period after that where I felt and was told that that was an American thing and that I couldn't really be Indian and also be that strange American thing. And for me, one of the most precious integrations that I've experienced is finding and living in a community of other South Asian queer people where we know that not only are we able to be South Asian and queer and have full lives in both of those worlds, but also that there's a long history of not necessarily, we might not call it gay or lesbian in South Asian history, but there is a history that our people have always been there. We've always been part of the community, and there doesn't have to be that breakdown or tension or divide at all.
Minal Hajratwala, our guest this hour. Her new book, again, is called Leaving India, My Family's Journey from Five Villages to Five Continents. When we come back, we'll talk more about that question of identity, both sexual identity and identity as an Indian American, what Minal's parents' reaction was to that particular story and how they continue this ongoing journey of being a new resident of a new land. More with Minal Hajratwala in just a moment. Her book again, Leaving India, My Family's Journey from Five Villages to Five Continents. If you'd like to join our conversation, here's the number. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. If you're a new resident to the United States, or if you've gone through the kind of experience that the Hajratwalas have and want to contribute your own story about becoming part of this country while still holding on to your own, we welcome your calls. Again, the number 866-733-6786, or email us at forum@kqed.org. That's forum@kqed.org. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our guest this hour, Minal Hajratwala. Her book is called Leaving India, My Family's Journey from Five Villages to Five Continents, a story about identity and family and integration between one country and another. We welcome your participation in our conversation as well. If you have a story about your own coming to this country and like to share it, here's the number. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or email us at forum@kqed.org. We'll get to your calls in just a moment. Right before the break, Hajratwala, you were talking about your own coming out as a lesbian and the way in which that both conflicted with traditional commentary on Indian identity, but the way in which you also pulled back a kind of history and tradition that was supportive. But that had to be a particularly difficult time for your parents, who, after all, before you came out, wanted to arrange your marriage.
Yes. You know, my parents definitely went through a difficult time with that, and so did I. And I have to give them a huge amount of credit because they really, over the past, they've had now 20 years to adjust, but they've really done so valiantly, you know, and I think that what happens is that our parents love us and they want us to be happy, and they have an idea of what that means because they know what made them happy and what made, what has worked for them in their generation. But once they were able to see that I needed something different in order to be happy, they really have been great about it. And I have to also say that with this book, they were full force behind it. They helped so much. They introduced me to relatives. They traveled with me part of the time. They translated. And we just had a book launch a couple of weeks ago at the Booksmith in The Hate. And my mother made hundreds of samosas for the party afterwards. So they've really embraced the book. And their unconditional love of me is really one of the most amazing things in my life.
We should mention that Meenal Hajratwala will be at the Makeout Room for a session called Writers with Drinks. That's on 22nd Street here in San Francisco between Mission and Valencia, 7:30 on Saturday night. If you'd like to be at that, that's when that event will take place. Setting aside for a moment the question of sexual identity, though, the question of arranged marriage must be a powerful question still for people of your generation, because that still seems to be such a powerful force within Indian tradition and culture, and not something that's part of the past, that's something that's still thought to should play a role in the 21st century.
Yes, many of my cousins are living very happily in arranged marriages and are arranging marriages for their children. You know, India itself is so diverse and Indian Americans are so diverse that there's really a range of experience. So it does go all the way from arranged marriages to people who really encourage their kids to date and want their children to find partners that way. And I also know people of my own generation who resisted their parents' attempts to arrange marriages for them. And now in their 30s, having tried dating for 15, 20 years and finding out how great that is, are kind of open to it again and are interested in being set up. And so arranged marriage, I think, also has itself undergone some tradition. I don't think there are too many people who do it the way that my grandparents did it, where they didn't even meet the person beforehand. Now it's sort of an arranged dating situation.
And there's also this sense within your book, while we often associate the word caste in a negative way because of the social stratification and prejudice that it implies, that it's also a force of continuity, and that part of what's behind arranged marriage in part is this sense of holding on.
It is. I think in the diaspora in particular, there is an impulse to hold more tightly to things like arranged marriage and caste because it's not as solid as it was in the old country. You know, in the village where my parents grew up, where my father grew up in India, the neighborhoods are arranged by caste. So you don't have to do any particular work to stay within your community. It's really right there for you. In a strange land, you might not know someone of your own caste and community for three states over. So there's an impulse to hold on to that just as a sense of continuity and familiarity from childhood. And then at the same time, there is always this tension to change. And I think that that's true for people of any culture. You know, I grew up in suburban Michigan. I read the Little House on the Prairie books. And I don't think there's anybody on the prairie except maybe the Amish who still live in the way that their great-great-grandparents of that time did.
My daughter loved those books too.
Yes.
Meenal Hajratwala is our guest, Leaving India, My Family's Journey from Five Villages to Five Continents, her book, and to our calls. Let's go first to Monica, who joins us this morning. Monica, go ahead, please.
Hi, Hi, this is Monica from San Francisco, and I really find this really interesting and timely. My family is actually Guyanese, and I was born there, and we came to the United States in 1979. And there's always been this tension for me and my sisters about being not Indian, because we're not from India, we're from Guyana, but people thinking we are, and having to explain our whole history, basically the history of indentureship, to people when they ask where we're from. Sometimes we do say we're from India, depending on the context. And then there's also the sense of feeling maybe not as not of the same class as some of the people who came from India, given that our ancestors were laborers and the people from the Caribbean are of a lower class and poorer when we're uneducated. So we always struggled with feeling maybe not Indian and being Indian at the same time. And another thing that I've been thinking about, my sisters and I are all partnered with Caucasians. And so our children are now 3 times removed from India, and I'm struggling with trying to instill my daughter a sense of where she's from. Is she from India? Is she from Guyana? And she wants to learn about Indian. What's Indian? And I can't explain that to her.
Let me hold you there, Monica, if I might. Yeah, you've raised a lot of really interesting points, ones that I'm sure are common and well understood by many people who go through this story. Monica, thank you. On the question first of this tension and, as Monica put it, a sense in some ways of inferiority because of being from Guyana as opposed to directly from India, the sense of her family was more of the indentured servants that you first came about as opposed to the more entrepreneurial class. How common are those sorts of tensions between people who have a distant connection but not so much one in the present tense?
Very common. I think that that's actually a really significant aspect is that when we talk about the Indian diaspora, for example, it's really not one thing. Mm-hmm. It's so many different communities across. This book itself goes to 9 countries, and that doesn't even include Guyana and other places. So it's at this point, it's 50, 60 countries that have really large Indian populations. And the experience is very unique in each of those places. And there is certainly tension. I mean, Indians in some ways are some of the most provincial people in the world, and people even from one village will think that the other village is not so good and really they're better off than the people in the other village. So that kind of inferiority, superiority thing is common. I think the thing that I've learned is that one doesn't have to take that on personally. You know, you can look at that and say, oh yeah, I am inferior and my people are not as Indian. Or you can say, look, we're all Indian as we want to be. And we're all American as we want to be, and we're all as Guyanese as we want to be. And there's power for me in choosing how much of that identity to claim and really not trying to quantify or compete on any of those.
Monica also mentioned the question mark of that there she's partnered and her other relatives with Caucasians. You write about that some in your book too, that some of your cousins and I think your is it your brother as well who dated and what sort of push and pull is involved in that? Is that so fundamental about if you want to maintain your identity, having to partner with someone who shares that same one?
My brother married a white woman who was his high school sweetheart, and they have 3 beautiful daughters, my nieces, who are mixed race. And there are now millions of Americans who are of mixed race, as we know from the last census. I don't think that identity is a fixed thing. I don't think culture is a fixed thing. It always changes. Even if you look at someone who's sort of pure-blooded Indian living in Bombay, those kids are eating McDonald's, they're wearing jeans, they're partying late at night, they're smoking cigarettes, you know, they're not doing anything that's really different from what a teenager over here would do. So I don't think we can say that some of those things are Indian and some of those things are not Indian. And at the same time, you look around San Francisco and there are thousands of people doing yoga. So I think that we're in a place now in a globalized world where more change and flexibility is possible, and that with that flexibility, we can see that as a kind of loss, or we can see that as a kind of opportunity to really claim our own identities. You know, I think that if we feel the loss, it's important to mourn that. And there is always going to be some loss, and it's important to acknowledge that too.
And is it also that identity is defined by something other than just race?
Absolutely. You know, I think that we can look at all those categories like race, gender, sexuality, social class, education level. And for some people, some of those will feel stronger than others. But, you know, I also have an identity as a poet, for example, that is really at my core. And I don't know that, you know, I have that much in common with somebody else who identifies as a poet. Does that make that alone make us a community? Maybe not. So identity is in this place of being much more open, I think, for us than it has been maybe in the past.
Ayman joins us next in San Francisco. Ayman, go ahead, please.
The question that I have is, I'm Egyptian and I'm gay and I live in San Francisco. I left Egypt because of my sexuality mostly. When I went back to visit, I felt like I couldn't relate back to Egypt. I couldn't relate back to my family, to my community, because of now that I have rights and I experienced how to have rights as a gay man. How do you feel when you go back to India about being gay and everybody around you, nobody's accepting you? How do you feel about that?
It's a good question. In my family, I think there is a real diversity of opinion, but in terms of the relationship, when I walk into someone's house, they accept me. They will feed me. They will make sure I'm comfortable. They will be very welcoming. They will want me to come back. And so I'm a proponent of the idea of a family as a big tent. You know, I think we can look at a family as an enforcer of tradition and rigidity and an exclusive club that you're in danger of being kicked out of all the time. But we can also look at a family as a place that embraces diversity and that includes everybody because of this blood connection, whether or not they fit some idea. And we all know, you know, we've had the Thanksgiving dinners with the alcoholic uncle and the heroin addict nephew. And, you know, there's all this kind of stuff that happens in a family. And sometimes being gay is the least of it. Now, that obviously is different from family to family. And that is not to dismiss the tension and the difficulty that you feel going home. But I do hope that there is space within a family that is built on love to open up those relationships.
Ayman, thanks for the call. It also sounds like for you that, as difficult as it may have been for your parents to accept your sexual identity, that having your parents on your side is in a sense having a great additional sort of lobbying force within your extended family.
Yes. I mean, you know, I wouldn't say that my parents are lobbying for me as a lesbian per se. And in fact, many of my relatives are finding out about my sexuality
in this
now,
book. Yeah.
Yeah, in the book or even right now in the moment of the book tour, because I'm speaking about it publicly in a way that within the family, I don't think it's been a public conversation. And, you know, I'm open to seeing what happens. My experience with coming out over the past 20 years is that mostly it's been positive and that almost always there is eventually someone who comes up to me and says, thank you for being courageous enough to say that because that applies to my experience too.
Rustam in San Francisco, you're next. Go ahead, please.
Hi, I just want to thank Manal for coming out on the radio and talking about her experience as a person who is of a different immigrant family. I'm Iranian-American, and when you were speaking, I really felt all the various nuances that were going on. And in fact, last night I was listening to Nancy Agabian and Mahru Elahi read their books, talking about how sort of difficult and interesting it is to be an immigrant in America and be an American at the same time, not be an American. I feel divided between both worlds at the same time, and I just want to thank you for talking about it.
Rustam, thank you.
Thank you.
Here's a question from one of our listeners emailed in. Your book is fascinating. You're writing eloquent. Thank you. But my question is this. I learned from you that Fiji had an Indian majority for many years, and then it changed. Was this because the general population increased, or was there a concerted effort, either on the part of the Fijian government or the Indian population, that forced people out? This comes back again to this question of tension within a particular land.
Yes, and Fiji has a really interesting history. So Fiji was majority native Fijian, of course, with a small handful of British colonizers. And those British brought in an Indian population. And over time, the Indian population really expanded. And the Fijian population, meanwhile, suffered epidemics that often come with colonialism, like the measles. And so the Fijian population declined. The Indian population increased to the point of about 51%. So very evenly, actually, divided, but a slight majority. But at the same time, post-colonialism, Fijians held the governmental power. Indians had most of the economic power. And that was the status quo for 30 years or so. And then in the late 1980s, an Indian person was elected prime minister in Fiji. And then there was a military coup staged by native Fijians to overtake the government. And so as a result of that military coup and the violence that followed, many of the Indians left Fiji. So starting in about 1986, 87 to the present day, Indians have been leaving Fiji.
And what about the relationships there? Monica called earlier about the that she's partnered with a Caucasian man, and so there's this question of identity. Has that played out in other places, in Fiji or New Zealand or other countries, where those same issues come up with Indians marrying Fijians, so forth?
Absolutely, and not really just with marriage. I mean, my cousins in Hong Kong, for example, their children go to Hong Kong schools, and they grow up speaking Cantonese. And so some of them have, in English and in Gujarati, they have a Chinese accent, and it's sort of humorous, but it's also great for them because they're able to be part of their own country where they live. And at the same time, for their parents, it certainly raises this question of identity. Did we make a mistake? Are we turning our children into something we didn't mean for them to be?
Anu is next in San Pablo. Anu, go ahead.
It's nice to hear you speak about your work. I'm calling because I'm a second-generation Indian-American. Both of my parents are from India. However, they decided that they should raise me. I was born here, and I'm in my 30s. And my parents, at the time, in the 1970s, felt that my best shot to be happy in the United States would be to be raised as American as possible. So they didn't teach me Hindi. They didn't teach me a lot about the culture. And I grew up essentially like any other American kid. But what I found is that people look at me and they instantly ask me, well, where are you from? And my answer is, well, I'm from New York because that's where I was born. That's where I grew up. But that's not the answer that people are looking for. So what I found as I started to be an adult is that I wanted to know a little bit more about what this place was, what this culture was, that everybody assumed I had, but I didn't necessarily feel that I had. And so in my adult life, in my professional life, I've been working more and more to get to know Indians. I work in the visual arts, which is like literature and anything basically that's not engineering or the sciences or law is kind of a strange profession for Indian Americans. But increasingly I find other people who are also creative arts people who are from a South Asian background. And for me, that's actually how I've been reconnecting or perhaps connecting at all with the culture that I come from.
Anu, thank you. It's an interesting question that keeps coming up, this where are you from? You've been asked that question because people make certain presumptions. So in a sense, Anu is raising this question that even though her automatic answer might have been New York, because of the way in which people are viewed, particularly people of color, you have to reach back almost whether or not you want to reach back.
Right. I mean, I actually struggled with this question, as many of us do, for a lot of our lives. My family is from India at some point, but also from Fiji, and there are many layers to where I'm from. I grew up in New Zealand for 7 years. And so I've started sort of asking back, actually, when I encounter that question now. Now I have the book, so I can say, well, you can read the book to find out where I'm really from. But really, I'm interested in where that question comes from, because I do think that it is a particular manifestation of subtle American racism, that when you look at a person of color, particularly someone who's not African American but a person of another color, and you say, where are you from? You're saying that that person somehow is not from here. And we don't know that. You know, we don't know by looking at someone whether they're from San Francisco or Canada, if they're a white person. And the same way, you don't know whether someone is fifth generation Japanese American or from Japan last week. And the assumption that there is, that that's an appropriate way, especially at the beginning of a conversation to start out, I've started pushing back with that. And I say, I'm always interested in that question because I wonder why you're asking.
Scott writes in, I was wondering if Ms. Hatrajwala would describe the difference in Indian immigration to Canada and the United States. P.S., Dave, you mentioned that Canada and the U.S. were not part of the British Empire. As a Canadian, I can assure you that we are still subjects of Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II. Scott, thanks for the correction on that.
Thank you. And partly because of that relationship, Canada has had a somewhat more open border for other parts of the British Empire. So Indians went to Canada earlier than they came to the United States. And even now, in the sort of post-1965 period, Canadian immigration has been open to Indians from various economic classes in a way that Indian immigration to the United States has been pretty restricted by education and profession.
And to Farah, who joins us from Menlo Park. Farah, go ahead.
Yes, hello. Thanks so much for the program today. I'm actually a member of the Chitreshtas dance company trained by my guru, Pandit Chitreshtas, in the art form of Kathak, classical dance of North India. And I'm just really appreciating the conversation. And it really strikes me, actually, as far as what we're a part of. We have a school here in the Bay Area as well as in India. But specifically here, we're seeing these young kids coming in, you know, their parents. Some, like myself, where the parents may have come in the 70s, born, brought up here, so of course more adults at this point, but now their kids coming to our institution, and how our Guruji is really connecting them to their culture again through the arts, ensuring that they understand not only about the tradition of the art forms, but the relevance not only to maintain their history and culture, but to really ensure its relevance in the modern context and how that's shaping their identity, even in their day-to-day societies. So we're seeing these kids, and especially these teenagers who are more at the level where they're dissecting these things, thinking about what does it mean to be Indian American, and are often drawing these very lessons through the art. So we're really fortunate to have, of course, a guru such as Pandit Das ensuring this and really having a place like these programs to continue this kind of dialogue.
Farah, thank you.
Thank you, Farah.
Here's another question of a very different sort, which points out, I think, an interesting question. And Casey writes, what about discrimination by Indians toward Indians? Currently, some Indians are going back to India because the standard of living they can get there is so much better than they can in the United States. And in part, that's because of discrimination in India. Successful Indians, Casey writes, sometimes feel no compunction about hiring servants for sub-living wages.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that there is, you know, I don't know that we can call that discrimination as much as it is the product of just a highly, highly stratified class structure and caste structure. And on a caste basis, there certainly is discrimination, and it's pretty awful. It's really beyond the kind of discrimination that I've ever experienced as an American, the way that people of what are considered to be the lower castes in India are treated is pretty criminal. And at the same time, there is also another kind of level of it, which is just that there is this inequality between the first world and the third world. And so when people move from the United States to India and they take dollars, $1 is worth more than 50 rupees. So automatically you're just in this privileged position. And some of that is just a function of globalization and the long, long legacy of colonialism that we all still live with.
One last emailed question. I'm curious to hear your comments about whether or not there are tensions between Indian immigrants who are here as wanted immigrants through H-1B visas and those who are not. H-1B visas back in the news again now. Do you see that tension?
Yes, I think I'm not sure. You know, I know that I'm not sure what's meant by the unwanted immigrants, but in the Indian community in particular, there certainly is a proportion of the community that is more working class. And there, I wouldn't say there's a tension within the community as much as there is just a diversity that is often not recognized. I think that some of us tend to think of and like to think of ourselves as a kind of model minority community that is high achieving and high earning and so on. And that really neglects the fact that there is this huge, huge portion of our community that is struggling and that it's working class and that doesn't have all the privileges, and that we actually as a community have a great deal in common with other people of color and other working class communities that we might not recognize if we ignore that part of our community.
But there's still a long ways to go in making that next step, making that journey. In some ways, that goes back to what we began our conversation about, that just as in South Africa in the early part of the 20th century, there was a tension between blacks and Indians. That's still a divide and a tension here that a next step needs to be taken?
I think so. I think it's in progress, though. The Obama administration, for example, is appointing more Indian Americans than any other administration prior. And I do think that we're seeing coalition building that's very strong on the part of some progressive Indian Americans. And at the same time, we are seeing people like Bobby Jindal, governor of Louisiana, who's sort of going the other way toward the other side of the racial divide.
In the book, toward the end, you write, what then is the fabric of the shared identity that seems to persist, though in places it may fray? Is it still, after so many generations, India? What persists for you?
I think there's some kernel of it that is India, but a lot of it is actually the creativity that we bring to our own ideas of India. You know, for many people, particularly in parts of the diaspora that have been several generations now out of India, the thread back to India itself as a country is pretty thin. But what we have is the creativity that we have brought to our lives in new places.
Meenal Hajratwala, her book is called Leaving India, My Family's Journey from Five Villages to Five Continents. Thanks very much for being on our program today.
Thank you so much, Dave.
And again, she will be at the Makeout Room. Writers with Drinks is the way the event is titled. That's on 22nd Street, 7:30 on Saturday night. Forum is produced by Tina Lauerberg, along with Kevin Guillory, with additional assistance this week from Amanda Stupai and Erica Kelly. Our engineer is Dave Freeman. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.